And also, I'm going to, the topic list is, there's one I forgot on that one I handed out. But it's also flexible, so it depends a little bit on what, because the structure, so the course is effective field theories, which is this great organizing principle for everything, really. And it's just how to systematically take advantage of ratios of scale in any physical problem. And so the idea is to first do some the formalism, but then apply it in a whole bunch of cases, just because it applies everywhere. And really, the broader the class of cases to consider, the better. And so whether we get through everything, I had a menu of things that I wanted to go through, some of which are kind of unusual applications. And I wanted to do non-relativistic and relativistic ones, and time-dependent ones. And so whether you, which ones you are interested in seeing can control which ones we do. So also think about when you see this list, which I'll rewrite here for you here now, think about which topics, if there's a topic there that you'd particularly like to see, let me know so that I can make sure that we do that one and not other ones. Because it may be that we're going to, if we end at the end of March, there are 11 lectures because there's a spring break in the middle of February. So there's 12 weeks, but 11 Fridays that we would be having classes. And there's more than, actually there's a lot, I think I've got 12 topics here. But each one might take longer than a day. So here's so it's an introduction to and the topic wish list would be, so there'd be the zero order thing is just, I'll do a toy example just because to set up what the issues are. Set things up, so that'll do probably today. Then there'll be the formalism, so the low energy expansions. Next would be closely related to this. You'll see is the issue of regularization or normalization. This will be kind of why normalization is a good thing. And why renormalizability is also why it's so important in physics. And it will be, you know, it'll turn out that it's the dominant thing at low energies. And power counting rules. And this is the nitty-gritty of effective field theories. It tells you which parts of an effective field theory are needed in any order in accuracy in the low energy expansion. It's the thing that is the main tool, but it's the one that most people don't internalize. So the weakness that when most people use effective field theories, they're not systematic about doing this, and this is probably the most important thing in the whole course. Then now the various examples. So there's Goldstone particles. And nonlinear realizations. So that's when you have spontaneous image breaking, specific things that arise in that case. There'll be examples from QED. So that could be, and in particular, I would use the examples from QED as a way to set up using dimensional regularization in effective field theories. You'll see that the idea is that you divide your theory into a low energy part, high energy part, and normally there'd be a cutoff that distinguishes the two. And you're kind of trying to parameterize the contributions of high energy things in low energy observables. And so it's mostly dimensional analysis and keeping track of the scales. And so that cutoff is going to play the role of it's very similar to what you would have done if you'd had a regularization, and that's kind of the tie-in to renormalization and regularization. But it makes it sound like dimensional regularization is cannot be useful in this kind of setup, because it sounds like the whole point was to separate high energy from low energy, and so you needed something to do that. Whereas dimensional regularization, you're keeping all possible momenta, and you're continuing in the dimensions of space-time. So it sounds like you're necessarily keeping all energies, and that's naively true, but it's not really true. And so you can set effective field theories up using dimensional regularization, because by keeping the things up to at low energies, getting the high energy theory wrong by dimensionally regularizing the low energy theory, the error you make is just one piece of ignorance of the high energy physics, and so you can always absorb it into renormalizations of things in your low energy theory. And when push comes to shove and people actually do calculations, if the calculation is not really easy, they always do it in dimensional regularization. So this is kind of these two are probably the most important parts of the story. So that's what the QED, and the QED comes in because it also makes gauge invariance really simple and that kind of thing. And there's non-relativistic. Excuse me. So how does this argument change if you're not doing relativistic particles? It's different, but not conceptually different. The point particle limit. What you find when you do this is that normally you learn quantum field theory, you learn quantum mechanics, then you learn maybe, depending on how you come into it, you might learn second quantization, which would be quantum mechanics where the wave function is now an operator, and it's useful for describing many particle systems. And then you then would often then do relativistic quantum mechanics, which is naturally done in terms of second quantization, because for relativistic problems, you have no option about, there's no way you can do single particle relativistic quantum mechanics. You always have antiparticles, so you have to phrase it in a language which allows you to change the number of particles, which is what second quantization does. And this is going to be retro in the sense that this will start with quantum field theory, and what you find yourself doing is deriving non-relativistic field theory in a systematic approximation here. And here we start deriving quantum mechanics as the low energy limit of a quantum field theory, where the energies are so low that you don't see any of the excitations of a system, and all you see is its center of mass motion. And then the effective field theory in that case will be the quantum field theory of the center of mass motion, which you'll recognize as being quantum mechanics, because x will be your variable. But the nice thing is that it allows you to systematically embed all the corrections that you see quantum mechanics as an approximation to the full theory, and so that tells you what the deviations from it are in a way which wouldn't have been so simple if you were just taking taking them as being logically different. All right, point particles. Then there's kind of a stepping back from that to internal degrees of freedom. So this is an excited state. This is kind of related to this in the sense that if you think of an atom, there's two scales in the problem. One is the size of the atom, and one is the energy levels that are between the ground state and the excited states. And that second thing is a smaller energy scale than 1 over the size of the atom. And so for non-relativistic systems, there's more than one scale in the problem, and when you do these comparisons of scales, the question is which one is the important one. And there's a regime where you can be tracking several excited states of and centered mass motion of an atom, but not resolving its size. And it'll look like a point particle with specific degrees of freedom on it, which is what would take you from the point particle quantum mechanics to, say, spinning particles or to particles with discrete labels on them. So that's another limit. There's time-dependent problems. So if you're a cosmologist, this is where you'd be most interested. That naively, this seems to rely on defining energy as an important thing. because we're going to discriminate states as being high energy or low energy. But if you don't have a time, that's fine if you have a time independent system where time translation invariance tells you energy is conserved. But if you have a time dependent problem where you've got background fields rolling around, the question is, can you set this kind of problem up? And you'd like to be able to, because you'd like to believe that you can solve things like cosmological problems where things are varying in time without understanding everything at once. The beauty of effective field theory is that it shows you why you can understand one scale at a time and not need to know what's going on at all energies. And so it'd be nice to be able to believe that we can understand quantum mechanics, the time dependence of the universe as a whole, on larger scales, without understanding all of quantum gravity at small scales at the same time. And there's reason to believe we can do that because we do seem to be able to understand cosmology. And so this is kind of addressed at the conceptual issues of doing effective field theories with time-dependent backgrounds. And you'll see that the issue here will hinge on effective field theories can apply, but only in the adiabatic limit of time dependence. But the same kind of techniques work. And there's boundaries. Effective field theories. So what do you have? What happens if your problem has boundary conditions or boundaries? How does that change the way you treat the low energy approximation? There's fluids and local thermodynamics. So this is kind of the mother of all effective field theories, where you're describing the thing you're not following is atoms. And the effective fields are the thermodynamic variables. But it's also a change, conceptual change, in the sense that up until now, and up until that point, the things that you were ignoring were at high energies. So if you didn't start with high energies, you never produced these high energy things you were ignoring, because energy conservation forbid you from producing them. But for fluids, the thing that you're ignoring is often not, it's not an energetic issue. You're looking at very low energy processes, but you're choosing to ignore the motion of the particles in the fluid, not because it costs you a lot of energy to move the particles around in the fluid. It's just that you don't have the resolution to see the motion. And that introduces a conceptual difference, because it needn't, but it can introduce a conceptual difference, in that it might be underpinning this whole story will be that it will be possible to write down a Lagrangian or the things we normally do when we define field theories that describe the low energy limit effectively in an efficient way. And that's going to start to fail here. So the first thing to look at would be the things where it doesn't fail, where you can actually describe the dynamics of fluids and not ask questions that see the fact that you are allowed to exchange information with the things you're ignoring. But the second part of it would be EFTs and open systems. And here the issue is that this is kind of also the decoherence story, that if you have a particle moving through a fluid, say, so that the electron that's came in moving through a gas that has electrons, it might be that the electron scatters into the fluid and then knocks another electron from the fluid out, and so the final electron you're looking at might not have been the one you started off with. And in that way, you can start entangling the thing you're looking at with the things that you were trying to ignore. And when you do that, a pure state can evolve to a mixed state in quantum mechanics. And that process cannot be described by unitary evolution. So there won't exist a unitary operator in the Hilbert space that takes your initial state and takes it to the final state, because if there were, it would always take pure states to pure states. And so there has to be a different way of describing this process, and there is one. And there's an analog of the analog of the low energy approximation in that case is in general, it's a complicated problem. You can't solve it in general, but the simplification in that case that corresponds to the simplification of having a high and a low energy regime is here, there will be a correlation length in the environment that you're moving through, and there's a time scale over which, beyond which you can't calculate perturbatively. Just because if you have no matter how small your Hamiltonian is, e to the iht, there's always a t large enough that no matter how small h is, you can no longer think of it perturbatively. That time scale, if that's a very long time scale compared to the correlation time in the environment you're moving through, there's an approximation you can use that allows you to infer the late time behavior, set up an equation for the evolution of the state, which is not a Hamiltonian evolution. So there will not exist a low energy effective theory in the usual sense, but it's still true that there's a similar simplification that you can use there, which actually I think it's underappreciated this exists. This is kind of the thing that condensed matter physicists know about, but particle physicists and cosmologists don't. And it probably has a lot of applications that haven't been explored yet. So for me, left to myself, I think we have to do these ones down to here, probably down to here. And then from here on in, I'd like to do this one and this one. And there's a certain amount of choosing we can do for these other ones. So that's where you should be thinking about, if there's something there that you particularly want to see, probably this one we should do, because it's not often done. But think about what you want to see. Any questions about that stuff? Can I start, or are you happy if I just jump in?
Is there a reference textbook now?
No. That's part of the problem. There's a bunch of review articles. So there's for the non-relativistic stuff in particular, there's a nice one by David B. Kaplan. I can give you the archive number for that later on, maybe. I might have it even here. So I'm going to distribute notes as I go along. And the only reason that, if everything goes according to plan, I can give you notes on this as I go along. But if it doesn't go according to plan, then I might be behind on the notes. Parts of this, so the first part of it, the notes that I would give you were essentially, I've written review articles, and those are on the archive, so I can give you those archive numbers too. So up to about here, that I can do. So, and I'm hoping that I'll be ahead of the curve so that I can be doing these notes before we get there in class, but that's the plan, is to make notes. But the David B. Kaplan reference I can give you now, because I have it with me, that's... I'll give you more. There's a lot of effective field theory reviews, but this one is particularly nice. So that's kind of aimed. He heads kind of fairly quickly into non-relativistic problems, and then he's aimed at nuclear physics, so it, heavy quark effective theories and that kind of thing. But the arguments he's making, pick in the beginning, are very general ones, and he has a very kind of a physical way of describing things. So. Okay. So the notes that I'm hoping to hand out to you, I've started here, so it's not like it's completely theoretical. But you'll see that they parallel the ones right now, which I've got. It parallels a lot what's in my own review articles. Okay, so the way I wanted to start things off is to... the thought is that if you have some physical, if you have two scales in your problem, so let's say you have two masses, say two scales, two energy scales, so we might have a big mass which is much bigger than a small mass, but it doesn't have to be that. It could be small objects, two objects of different sizes, or it could be, it's really what counts as energy. Then if you calculate, observables, like say a scattering cross-section, which might be a function of the energy of the scattering and the masses, supposing you knew what that answer was in general, then if it's true that you know that there's a hierarchy of scales, which is the starting point of the whole effective field theory story. So the story is that if you have a hierarchy, so there's two very different mass scales in your problem, you can simplify your life by taking advantage of that hierarchy early on rather than later on. So if you have a hierarchy like that, then you can imagine, you know, if you calculate something physical, you could then take the answer and Taylor expand in the small ratio, right? You could write it as being approximately sigma of E M zero. Sorry. You can write it as a series. So I'll say sigma naught plus sum I j equals 1 infinity of some coefficients Cij times, say, 0 to infinity, powers of the small things, Ci to the j, say. So if the energy of interest are similar to the smaller of the masses, much, much smaller than the big mass, then if someone handed you the answer, it would be irresistible to start Taylor expanding everything in powers of, on dimensional grounds, this will be, you know, we could have pulled out a factor of, say, 1 over e squared on dimensional grounds, and then what's left will be dimensionless, and then it would be irresistible to start Taylor expanding everything in powers of the small things divided by the big things, because that's going to show you dominantly how the answer behaves, because the capital M dependence, if M is large compared to these other two things, is going to, once you start getting into the series where you're looking at one or two powers, it's becoming negligibly small. So most of the shape of this function is a function of the variables you're tracking in detail will only really depend on the first few terms here. I'm kind of assuming here that everything's analytic, and there will be complications to this, that this, sometimes things will depend on logarithms of E over M or M over E and stuff like that. And so we'll deal with those when we get there, but it's still true that there are ways of dealing with those logarithms, but it's still true that you're trying to capture the small things, simplify when in a limit that one mass is larger than the other ones, and you're mostly interested in the low energy limit that depends on E and little m, and the small deviations that are sensitive to this large m in the limit that the energies of interest are smaller than this large m. And so the hard way to do these kind of calculations is to calculate the whole thing, and then once you've got your answer, to Taylor expand the answer and do that separately for every physical thing you could have imagined calculating. And the point of the exercise that we're about to go down is that there's a much more efficient way to do it, and the much more efficient way to do it is to you would calculate these things from the Lagrangian of your system or your Hamiltonian of your system, and you can do that Taylor expansion. The earlier in your calculation you do that Taylor expansion, the easier your life will be. And the earliest place you can do it is in the Hamiltonian itself. So the logic will be that we can write down an equivalent Hamiltonian or Lagrangian to the one that you're interested in this regime where the energies and are of that the external things you're choosing are small compared to this large scale in your problem. And if you do your series expansion in powers of 1 over m, at that point in your Lagrangian, then you can calculate any observable you like from that Lagrangian that you're going to get. But the simplification has already happened, that the effective Lagrangian, the one that's coming to you as a series in 1 over m, will be something that you can calculate simply by taking the simplest possible observable. And then once you have that Lagrangian, you can calculate anything with it. And you've captured, in one fell swoop, the lowest powers of 1 over this large scale. So it's just really simplify your life as early as you can. So the answer, so observables, simplify. Once expanded in powers of E over M, and little m over m, and you start dropping terms. And where you stop depends on how accurate you want to get. You know, you can stop, you can go 1,000 times down the series But as long as you stop somewhere, it'll eventually, it'll simplify. Maybe that there. So the effective field theory idea do the expansion as early as you can, which will be, i.e., in the Lagrangian itself. To make life easy. So that sounds very benign, mundane observation, but you'll see that it actually, it's a powerful observation because it's gonna, the things that you're led to explain things that were otherwise very hard to understand. In the 60s, people had had their knickers in a twist about renormalization theory and how it was very crazy. You have divergent things, you subtract divergent things from them, and then you compare the answer to experiment to 15 decimal places and it works, and you know, why does that make sense? And there's an interpretation of that whole program, the renormalization program, as being a special case of this exercise, where the thing that's high energy in that case is the stuff you don't know about yet. And it, this way of thinking about things organizes the way you think about those other conceptual issues as well. But that's the thought. So the whole term is embellishing that thought. And so what I want to do is take this an example, because it's kind of a hypothetical thing. I'd like to take a concrete example where we just have two scales, we'll just calculate things, and you'll see in that example how, whereas it's gonna look like we're gonna calculate things, we're gonna calculate some cross-sections and we'll have a coupling constant in our problem. And it's gonna look like the approximation we're gonna make is perturbation theory in that coupling constant. But you'll see that a lot of things that we're gonna draw, conclusions we're gonna draw, are actually more valid than you would have thought if you had thought that the limitation to your calculation was the smallness of this coupling constant we're gonna talk about. That there's some consequences that are actually much more general and are really relying on this low energy expansion and not on what you thought would be the perturbative expansion. And so there's many properties that kind of are very general properties at low energy, which are more robust properties than you sometimes are led to believe. And so this is a common thing in physics that you find, you know, an example is if you do look at a superconductor where, you know, in the Cooper pair story, you neglect the Coulomb interactions and you follow this feeble phonon interaction between two charges. And it sounds like it's a nice physical picture, but you'd be lucky to have that give you anything more accurate than, you know, something within an order of magnitude of what actually happens in experiments. But for some superconductors, that actually works to the 10% level. And if you wanted to understand why was it working that accurately, what's going on is really a low energy approximation, that the approximation that you're really making isn't as bad as it sounds because it's the consequences that you're drawing are very robust consequences at low energies of a symmetry statement rather than a detailed consequence of what you thought the approximation was you were making. And so being able to identify what your predictions rely on is crucial in physics because it's all about the theoretical error. And so this is a way of identifying what the important theoretical error is. Where is the sign-in sheet? Do you guys have that? Can I get you to sign this? We also had a question. If we were to move this class till 9:30, would that be a problem for you? And if we were to take the afternoon class and move it to 2 from 2:30, is that a problem? Okay, we may not do it, but I just wanted to know if there are conflicts because it'll depend on. Okay, so let's do the toy example. So and it'll be one that you know and love, almost certainly. So let's do a complex scalar field with a Mexican hat potential. So it's so we'll have a complex phi. And we'll have a symmetry under which phi goes to phi times the phase for some constant omega. And our Lagrangian will just take to be, we'll have a kinetic term, d mu phi star d mu phi, and then we'll have a potential, which is a function only of phi star phi, so that it's symmetric, and we'll take the quartic one that's a Mexican hat, so we'll take v to be lambda over 4 phi star phi minus v squared squared. So what I want to do is start off saying, supposing this is the theory of the world, and we'll assume that lambda is much, much smaller than 1. And we'll also, as you'll see in a second, we're going to be mostly interested in the regime where phi and v are of order 1 over lambda. So we're going to take lambda to be small, and we're going to want these guys to be parametrically big. So if you like, another way of saying that is that v is of the order of some other scale mu divided by lambda, where when we take lambda small, we're going to imagine mu being fixed. And in this regime, the claim will be, this is the regime in which you usually are when you analyze this system, and this is the classical regime. So the point of this statement here is that we like to do perturbation theory in lambda. But perturbation theory in lambda, you might have thought, would mean, well, when lambda is equal to 0, we turn off the whole potential, and we just have the kinetic energy. And that would be a series in lambda you could have done. But that's not the series in lambda we want to do. What we want to do is the series where we imagine that lambda is small, but phi and v are large, so that some terms in this potential are going to survive as lambda gets small. And that's going to tell, and one of the things I'm going to have to do is argue for you that in this limit, the way to think about this problem is to think in the semi-classical approximation. So we first think of phi as a classical field, we minimize the potential energy to find what the vacuum energy is, and then we expand around that minimum, and that will be what the series in lambda will, that's the way the series in lambda will organize itself if we make these additional assumptions. So what we're going to do is we're going to just chug along, calculate things, some cross-sections as a series in lambda, we'll find the spectrum as a series in lambda, and then the cross-sections you'll see have a special property at low energies. You'll see that there are two particles. There's a heavy particle and a light particle. And you'll see that as long as we're at low energies compared to the heavy particle, the cross-sections are actually very simple at low energies. And they're simpler than you would have bargained for just on a... We're going to learn that it's simple to leading order in lambda, but you might have, if this has been the theory of the world, you might have thought we're going to find these cross-sections actually vanish at very low energies. Like a power of energy divided by the heavy mass. And you might have thought that maybe that's an accident to the fact we're working the lowest approximation in powers of lambda. And if this had been the theory of the world, you might have been interested in testing this theory by doing experiments, and you'd be worried that the cross-sections are smaller than you thought they were because the cross-sections are all very small at low energies if we had been in a regime where the mass of particle might have been too heavy to be produced in our accelerators, let's say. And so then you'd be very interested, do corrections in powers of lambda change this conclusion that the cross-sections are very small, and you'll see that actually the cross-sections are small to all orders in lambda. It's an exact statement. But this way of calculating that we normally do would have completely missed the fact that this is a very general statement, that the cross-sections are smaller than you would have thought. And so this is kind of the archetype situation where what's really going on is that you have this being small, but if you're interested in the regime where the energies are also small compared to the mass scale in this problem, then you're going to see that the some consequences are just really a consequence of that second thing and are actually true independent of how big lambda is. And it's useful to be able to distinguish between the consequences that rely on small low energies and smallness of lambda.
So you say you lose most of that information when you do effective field theory?
No, effective field theory just makes the consequences of low energy explicit and obvious. So the smallness of the cross-section will be true when we just don't use effective field theory. But it won't be, you're going to see it's going to happen, it's going to look like a miracle, because I'm going to get a cross-section, it's going to be sum of three things which all look like they're big, but they all cancel. And it wouldn't have been obvious why they were canceling. But when we redo the calculation as effective field theory, you'll just see it's just obvious from the get-go that everything had to be small, independent of how big lambda was. So it's kind of a nice example because it shows you how it's not new information, but it's better organized information.
How is the 5 scaling is one of the ranges that turn out to be
I'll show you that right now. The things I just told you was a preview. I'll say more in detail. So ask me again if I don't clear that up. Okay. You know, I have to tell you that this is my favorite topic to teach because I learned this as a graduate student, but it wasn't really emphasized. It actually was emphasized, but it was kind of a parenthetical thing in the quantum field theory course. But this is a way of organizing everything you think about in physics. And if once you adopt this, you'll never go back. It's really an efficient way to think about everything. Because nature comes to us with many, many scales. And the fact of nature is that you didn't have to understand them all at once. You can understand atoms without understanding nuclei. You can understand, you know, Newtonian physics without understanding atoms. And this is why. It's because we're always doing low energy approximations. There's some scales we don't have access to, but the heavy physics to a large approximation is not really doing anything. It's not really doing anything important. And the fact that you can quantify how unimportant it is really early in the problem is really underlying everything we know in physics. So it's a beautiful subject. It's really, if you forget everything you ever learned in graduate school except for this, you're still doing fine. So, all right. So let's do this perturbation theory. So what about, first of all, this limit? So the reason that I'm doing this limit is the point of this limit is that with this limit, if you ask with this assumption, where are the lambdas in this Lagrangian, you'll see that the lambdas are actually, are every term has the same lambda dependence. So if I say that V is equal to mu over lambda, and I say that phi is equal to, say, curly phi over lambda, and I plug that into that Lagrangian, right, we're going to get, we had minus d mu curly phi star d mu curly phi over lambda squared. And then the potential energy will be minus lambda over 4. Now we have phi star phi over lambda squared minus mu squared over lambda squared squared. And so this whole thing, you know, if I pull out the lambdas, I get 1 over 4 lambda. And so squared. Pull out a lambda. What did I do here? I think I probably wanted a root lambda. There's a convention whether or not you think of lambda or lambda squared. Let me make sure I'm doing what I did in my notes so I don't screw this up. Yeah, it's root lambda. I misspoke here. What I wanted to write was this. So 1 over root lambda. And now you're seeing why. If you didn't know what the answer was before you started, this is how you'd figure it out. So here we had now lambda. So I now get a lambda squared when I pull it out, and I get what I told you. And this is now lambda, right? So this is 1 over lambda times a Lagrangian as a function of these other guys that doesn't depend on lambda. So why do you care about that? The reason you care about that is that, you know, what are you going to do with this Lagrangian? I should actually ask, so have you, you've all taken a quantum field theory course, have you? Or is that, who has not had a quantum field theory course? Not at all, or? Okay, but are you happy with Feynman rules and calculating cross sections? Those of you who have not done quantum field theory, and how about path integrals? Are you happy with path integrals? Okay, so most of what I'm going to use is just actually Feynman rules, so it shouldn't be a big deal. But you've had classical field theory, right? I mean, ENM and that kind of thing. So that part of it should be good. So, but. The thing I'm going to say now, tell me if this is resonating with you, because the level at which I'm going to use path integrals is going to be more or less this, so it's not going to be a detailed thing. So the thing about path integrals is you're normally, the things you're calculating are amplitudes, say, and they're coming to you as a path integral over, you imagine during, if you're doing quantum mechanics, what you'd do is you'd be interested in the amplitude, say, of starting at some initial position and ending at some final position at some later time. So I'd have initial position at some time t equals zero, say, and I have some final position at some time capital T, and I'd get, a way of writing that amplitude is the integral over all paths where the paths start at t equals zero at this position and they stop at t equals capital T at this position. So that means these are paths x of t with the property that x of zero is equal to x initial and x of capital T is equal to x final. Then the sum over all paths, you write it as an integral of a curly d of x of t, which just means summing over all paths in a way which can be defined, but I'm not defining it very well here. And then the thing that you're integrating is e to the I action, where the action is the integral dt of the Lagrangian from, I guess in this case, 0 to t. And this is a function of say the position and the momentum, you know, q dot. So this is the statement that if I calculate this quantity, this is the quantity that I would have calculated with if I'd done the same thing in the Schrodinger problem where I take the particular state and I evolve things forward with, you know, e to the minus I ht, and I ask what's the amplitude of having this final state. There's an argument that people make which says that, so if I wrote this as Q, I should be writing this as Q. Q is what I'm thinking of as being I'm using Q to distinguish, X is the thing I specify as the initial final point, and Q is the path between those two points. So here's the initial point, here's the final point. And I take all possible paths, and I sum up the e to the I action for each of these paths. And the answer I get at the end of the day is some complex thing, and the claim is it's this amplitude. That's the path integral story. And it has in this language, the reason that classical physics is important is that if you did this integral in the saddle point approximation, then the path that's most important is the one for which the thing in the exponent is stationary. So what you need to remember is for the saddle point approximation, if we're just doing an integral, so this is just a telegraphic aside on path integral. So if I was doing the integral, dx or ds, say, of e to the minus lambda times, let's say using zeta times some function of s. That integral, thought of as this ought to be some function of zeta. If zeta is large, you can, you know, there's an approximation to this integral as a series in 1 over zeta. Which comes by taking S and expanding it around any stationary point of F. So this is approximately, it turns out, e to the minus zeta F evaluated at X naught, you know, 1 plus order 1 over zeta. So when zeta is large, this will be a good approximation, where X naught satisfies that S naught. DF DS evaluated at S naught is equal to zero. So this is just a thing that you use from calculus, which you've probably seen. And then the analog of that statement here would say that for this functional integral over positions, if it's true that the Lagrangian has some big number in front of it, then to the extent that you're doing a series in 1 over that number, this will be well approximated by e to the I, this thing evaluated at the stationary point of the action, which is the analog of the thing, the stationary point of the function, and that's the classical solution. The classical solution is the thing that is the stationary point of the action, and so the classical path, if that's the classical path, taking e to the I, evaluate the classical path, will be a good approximation to an amplitude in the classical approximation, is the quantum mechanical version of this statement for calculus. Now, in field theory, it's the same kind of story, except now instead of particles, you're talking about fields. And so there'll be a functional integral sum over all possible field configurations. And if you'd be interested, the analog would be some amplitude of starting with some field configuration phi I at some initial time and ending with some final configuration phi f. And we'll integrate over all fields phi such that at the initial time, we're equal to phi I of x. So this would be phi of t equals 0 and x will be equal to the specified 5x. and so on. The final thing would be phi t equals t, and x will be phi final of x, of e to the I, the action, the integral dt. But now in the field theory, the Lagrangian comes to an integral over space of things. So this is the integral d4x of the Lagrangian density of phi and derivatives of phi. And the same story is true, that if you can find a large number in the Lagrangian, then things will be well approximated by this classical trajectory for the same argument. And the point of this argument is that the large number in this case is 1 over lambda. So, you know, dimensionally, I should have, you know, this has dimensions of action. This is the action. It has dimensions of energy times time. Really, this should have been S over H bar that appears here. That's how you see, that's where the quantumness comes in, the H bar. And I'm using, I'll always use units where H bar and C will be 1. So that's the reason I didn't write it. But you should be aware that, so those units I'm using. But you see that that it's kind of physically reasonable that you're getting the classical approximation when there's an overall coefficient of the Lagrangian, which is large, because that's really just saying that the action you're interested in is large compared to the quantum of action. So that's the classical approximation. So in this theory, you can see that lambda is appearing exactly everywhere that h-bar is appearing. And so lambda being small is like saying h-bar is small. And that's kind of, this is the story as to why that's the classical approximation. So the lesson is that if you have a small parameter which you can organize as coming out in front of your whole Lagrangian in 1 over the parameter, then that being small will correspond to this the classical approximation and perturbations around the classical approximation. Now, what will happen is that you're going to h bar lambda everywhere, so that your series in h bar is the series in lambda. Okay. And so if you're used to Feynman graphs, the classical approximation, the series that you're getting here, if you do this kind of thing and you keep these subdominant things, that series is the loop expansion. So the classical approximation, the 1, is the tree graphs. And then the first term here that's order h bar is the sum of things with 1 loop in it. And there's an argument that you go through that shows you that that's what h bar is counting. And so the loop expansion is the classical approximation in field theory. And what we're going to see, so even if you don't believe me, I'm just going to calculate tree graphs, and you're going to see they're all proportional to the same power of lambda. And if I had done the order 1 loop thing, you'll see that all the 1 loop graphs have the same factor of lambda in front of them, and it's 1 power higher than it was for tree graphs. And so that's kind of the ex post facto way of seeing that what I'm telling you is true. But the reason it's working is that the lambda is appearing everywhere h bar is appearing, and there's an argument that goes that in a path integral course you would learn that says that the series in h bar, given that h bar is appearing here, is the loop expansion. Okay. So given that, so because of this, you know, lambda goes to 0 is like h bar goes to 0. And so lambda, series and lambda, the bottom line is that series and lambda is the same thing as the loop expansion. And that's the same thing as a classical, semi-classical expansion. And that's because the sum of all tree graphs is the same thing as taking e to the I action and evaluating it at the classical solution, which is something that I'm not proving, but it's, you'd see that in a path integral course. But you don't need to know that in detail. Just, if you just take this as this fact as being true, that's all you need to know about path integrals for this course. And so what we're going to do is we'll do the series in lambda. But because it's a semi-classical expansion, the main message is that what I'm not supposed to do is take this, do the naive thing, where I say that this whole thing is ordered lambda. So the zeroth order thing is I turn V off, and then I do a perturbation in lambda. And the reason I'm not doing that is that because I've made this choice, I've made some of these terms get parametrically large as lambda gets small. And so that's reorganizing how you'd evaluate this path integral as a series in lambda. So the bottom line is that what we want to do is we want to find the vacuum first. So the first question is what's our spectrum? So what are the states? And so what we do semi-classically is we would first find what's the ground state, what's the minimum energy state, and then we want to find the states that are close to the ground state. And so in the classical approximation, we know how to do that. In the classical approximation, the ground state is the lowest energy state, and then near that will be the ones, the fields that have the least energy. So the the vacuum, so we want to find the spectrum. We're going to do it semi-classically. So the ground state is, which is what we call the vacuum, is the minimum energy configuration. The minimum energy classical configuration, because we're doing classical physics. So we need to know what the energy is for this Lagrangian. So if you take the Hamiltonian is related to the Lagrangian by, I take the Lagrangian and I subtract, sum over all the degrees of freedom, P Q dot or something like that, right? Have we got that right? You're right. Lagrangian is the Hamiltonian. I can't believe I've forgotten this. Yeah, right. The first way is right. So I would normally take the Lagrangian as a function of Q and Q dot, if you like, Qi and Q dot I, where dot is time derivative. I define P to be dl dQ dot. And then I define the Hamiltonian to be PQ dot minus the Lagrangian. That's what it is. I apologize for not remembering that. So I'm just going to do that in field theory. And the only thing that happens in field theory that's different is that the Qs. So now where QI, I was labeling all the different things and Q was the variable. So this might have been X, Y, and Z, if you like, I equals 1, 2, 3. But in field theory, what's happening is that you've got a variable, the variable is the field, but you have a different one for every point in space at a given time. So this is becoming phi of t and x. So the role of I is being played by x. This would have been a function of time, that's just time. And the role of Q is being played by phi. So when I write a sum over I, that's going to become an integral over x. And the Lagrangian is going to come to me as an integral over position. So I didn't write down a Lagrangian as a function of time. I wrote down a Lagrangian as a function of space and time because the fields are functions of space and time. And the Lagrangian is related to this thing by the integral d3x of L is the honest to God Lagrangian. So if I combine that and this sum as being an integral over x, and I figure out what h is also going to come as an integral over x, because this is an integral over x, and this is an integral over x. So we're going to get this as the integral d3x of some Hamiltonian density. And I can figure out what it is by applying this rule, that the Hamiltonian density will be, so h will be, from this it'll be, if I have a Lagrangian density, the canonical momentum for each field will be the derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to the time derivative of phi. And then the Hamiltonian density will be the canonical momentum times phi dot minus the Lagrangian density. Right? That's the translation of this general statement to the special case that everything's a function, an integral over local stuff. So I'm gonna just write down what this is for this Lagrangian. Is all I'm going to do now. So if I do that exercise for that Lagrangian, h is going to be, it'll be, I'm going to write it in the, I'm going to use the original variables. I'm not going to track. Once I've made this argument that lambda is counting loops, it's not going to be so important to use these new variables. I'm just going to use the original variables when I do the calculation. And you'll just see that it's going to be true that the loop expansion will be the lambda expansion. But in terms of those original variables, then this will be it'll be phi star dot phi dot plus grad phi star dot grad phi. And then there'll be plus v of phi star phi. That's what this Hamiltonian turns out to be. And again, phi dot is just ddt of phi. And grad is the spatial gradient. So what's nice about that is that it's positive. It's a sum of positive terms, right? So or sum of non-negative terms. It's actually, strictly speaking, the way I've written it is sum of positive terms. But it could have been true that that the potential energy could have had a constant piece in it, which was negative. The important thing is that it's bounded from below, so there is a minimum. But in this, the way I've written it, it's a sum of positive terms. So the minimum configuration is the one for which h is 0. If I can find any solution to h equals 0, that will be the minimum, because that's the h is bounded below by 0 by inspection. So h is greater than or equal to 0 for all phi. So h equals 0 is the ground state, classically, is the classical ground state. And so that's easy to see. So how do I get h equals 0? I make phi dot 0, so that means I have to have time-independent configurations. I have to have grad phi is equal to 0, so they have to also be space-independent, so they're just actually constants. Then I have to minimize v for those constant configurations, and I can minimize v. I've conveniently written the potential as a square, so I minimize v by making phi star phi equals little v squared. So that'll be the time derivative is 0, the space derivative is 0, and v of, let's call the ground state phi sub c. So v of phi sub c star phi sub c, we want that to be 0. And that's the same thing as saying that phi sub c star phi sub c is equal to v squared. So that's the classical vacuum. And of course, near the vacuum, if we drew this potential in field space, right, it's some sort of a Mexican hat. So we're just saying that the minimum is here, and it's actually a trough that goes around. So any one of those things is an equally good minimum. And if we want to know what the configurations are that are very close to the minimum, what they will be is they will be configurations that are very close, that climb the side of the potential a little bit. And so. So, and that's where the semi-classical part's going to come in. So classically, what's going to happen is that classically we have any field configuration at all that starts to climb the hill will give us all possible energies here. But quantum mechanically, what's going to happen is that this is for close to the minimum, this is going to look like phi squared. And so it's going to look like a harmonic oscillator. So we're going to get a whole bunch of little harmonic oscillator levels here. And in particular, the vacuum, the ground state will be not at exactly zero here. There'll be, you know, the energy levels of a harmonic oscillator are h bar omega plus a half. And so there's a zero point energy. And so there'll be a whole bunch of little states here, harmonic oscillator states at the bottom here, which will be a good approximation to what the quantum states are. And the bottom one will be the vacuum. And its energy to a good approximation will be the classical vacuum, zero, plus the zero point energy here, which we won't talk about until later. And then these states, the harmonic oscillator excited states, are all equally spaced because they're harmonic oscillators, and those are the particles. So the a free particle is something where if I have one of them, I have some energy, and that's its mass. If I have two of them, I have twice its energy, and that's because I have two particles, same mass. I have three of them, I have three times the energy, and the energies just add because they're not interacting. That looks like a harmonic oscillator. I have one step up, two steps up, three steps up. So the quantization of these levels will be the particles that this field is representing. And the series in lambda, when lambda is small, the unperturbed system will be the system, will be the, if I took lambda to be small, if I carried through the quantization problem in more detail than I'm going to carry it, I'm going to go right to the same where the cross section is. But if I had gone through the exercise of making these fields into operators and expanding around this classical vacuum, then, if I looked at the Hamiltonian as a function of lambda and took the leading piece, the unperturbed part, it would be this harmonic oscillator story here, which is the free particle Lagrangian. I will do that explicitly. And so these states here will be the particle states that phi is describing. And then the interactions, and they're going to be non-interacting because we're going to be working to just very deep in this well, which is the lowest order in this series in lambda, it turns out. And if we wanted to include the effects of lambda, we'll find that they start to interact, which is where they start to see this potential is not exactly a harmonic oscillator. And there's a whole story that we could pursue if we wanted to. So what I want to do is I want to write out this Lagrangian. So once I've got this classical minimum, that's the classical ground state, what I want to do is I want to write this Lagrangian as being, I want to take phi and write it as being that classical state plus a fluctuation And the fluctuation is what I'm going to think of as the operator. And so it's just a change of variables. In quantum field theory, this is not a classical field, it's an operator. But it, in this semi-classical expansion, what I'm supposed to do is think of this operator as being the classical vacuum plus the operator. And then in that, once I've done that, the operator that's the difference between this and the vacuum is small in the quantum sense, that its effects are suppressed by lambda. And so what I'm going to do is I'll say phi, I'll write it as being phi classical, which I can take it to be V, plus, let's call it psi. So it's just a definition. This was an operator, so this is an operator, and this is just the classical configuration. If I just plug this into Lagrangian was that, I just do the substitution, and I know that V is a constant, so it has no derivative, then I get minus d mu psi d mu psi, and then the potential here becomes minus lambda over 4. Phi star phi is V squared plus 2V, I guess it's plus V phi plus V psi star plus psi star psi, then minus V squared, so that just cancels this, squared. So if I write that out, that's minus d mu. What I'll do is because we've got things involving psi and psi star, let's just write psi as a real part and an imaginary part. And then if I do that, then if I just plug in, then we have that the Lagrangian is minus d minus. In fact, there's a conventional normalization factor. I'm going to actually write this as being just divided by the square root of 2. So this will become minus 1 half d mu psi right d mu psi right minus 1 half d mu psi imaginary d mu psi imaginary. There's no cross term because it's just I forgot to write the complex conjugate. Yeah, when I write, I mean adjunct. So my convention will be, if I write this for a number, I mean complex conjugate. If I write it for an operator, I mean the Hermitian conjugate. Because there's never a sense in which I'm ever going to talk about a complex conjugate of an operator. I always just mean Hermitian conjugate.
So the decomposition to real and imaginary
parts? Is the same thing. This would be the Hermitian. These are both Hermitian. And so if you like, I could define psi right to be psi plus psi star over root 2, I guess. And psi I could define to be psi minus psi star over root 2 I. If I define those two things, that they are both Hermitian. And then the potential becomes so the things that there's, it starts off quadratic in so this let me write this part here. This is going to be V 2V psi right, because this is V times psi plus psi star. But it's not, I guess, 2. It's psi plus psi star be root 2. And then we have plus 1 half psi right squared plus psi imaginary squared. This is that, and this is that. So let me just expand that out now. So I have minus V, where V is, so the first term will be, I'll have lambda over 2 V squared psi right squared. And I've got a cross term, which is, I'll have a 2, we'll take out the half, I'll still have the root 2, and I'll have to divide it by 4. So I have lambda over 2 root 2. I have the V goes along for the ride. Psi right squared plus psi imaginary squared. Then I have a quartic piece, which is, I have the 1/2 squared is a fourth, so I have lambda over 16 psi right squared plus psi imaginary squared squared. So in the semi-classical quantization of the field, what we're supposed to do is we're supposed to write this thing now in perturbation theory. We want to have an unperturbed Lagrangian that we know how to quantize, and a perturbed part which we can do perturbation theory in, which hopefully is proportional to lambda because we're trying to take advantage of the fact lambda is small. So if the part of this Lagrangian that's quadratic is something which you can solve that exactly, that's the free particle. That's the harmonic oscillator story I was telling you. If I quantize this plus this plus this, I'll get particles, the evenly spaced particles, and their mass is being controlled by this coefficient here. So the claim is, if I have a Lagrangian which was minus 1/2 d mu phi, minus 1/2 m squared phi squared, and I quantize the system, what I get is a bunch of particles where the Hamiltonian for the system will be sum over particle momenta of a dagger a for that particle. So this is the number operator, counting the number of particles, times the energy of that particle plus 1/2, which is the zero point energy. And the energy of that particle turns out to be, if I just go through this is now I'm just describing the answer of just doing standard quantization of this field. This energy turns out to be the usual relativistic energy. It's k squared plus m squared, where this m is this parameter here. And so this is the energy of a relativistic particle, where this m is the energy at zero momentum, which is what we mean by the mass, the rest mass. And so that just tells you, if you look at a Lagrangian which is quadratic like this, you can just read off this thing as being the mass, keeping in mind that we've taken a common factor out between the kinetic term and the mass term. I just tell you that because it allows us just to read off this thing from this, what the mass is of these particles. You're all happy with this, right? I don't want it to be unclear, but I don't want to flog it if you're happy with it. So this is, if you haven't seen quantum field theory, I'm telling you something new, and I'm not explaining it, because this is a quantum field theory result. If you just take this thing, think of it as being operators the way we're doing over here, turn the crank and ask, what's the Hamiltonian? Construct the Hamiltonian like we did from the Lagrangian. You get something which is the one I wrote down, but now it's operators, but they're all quadratic. If I do a change of variables, which is the Fourier transform, basically, where the field is sum over k of a sub k e to the I minus I e t plus I k dot x, basically, then that changes your Hamiltonian into this form, and you can just read off what these coefficients are, and this is what they turn out to be, is the bottom line. And this is why you think of this as being particles, because it's evenly spaced things. If I operate on the ground state with A star, I get a state with energy E. That's E more energy than the ground state did. If I operate twice, I get the 2E, and so I'm just basically creating particles, each of which has this energy. And the energy at zero momentum, this is the momentum, is what we mean by the mass. What do you mean by the size of the fluctuation? It's a usual quantum mechanical thing. So if I had a momentum eigenstate, what would you say the size of x is? It's something which is not defined, right? Because you haven't diagonalized x in that state. So what that could mean is what's the expectation value of x squared in that state, which is what you'd have to mean here. And so you could calculate it. You could calculate what's the expectation value of phi squared in a particle state. But the particle state is one that is not one for which the field is diagonal, is the important thing. So it's like pretty much like position momentum. You want to know, am I satisfying my criterion that it's order 1 over root lambda, phi?
No, but phi is no longer,
See, I'm building that in with this. I wanted phi to be of order 1 over root lambda. I redefined it, but then I unredefined it when I started actually doing everything. I went back to the curly phi was the thing where I had 1 over lambdas here. But then I went back to the original variables because it's actually, once I've shown you that this is true, the new variables aren't very useful beyond that.
Yeah,
So I went back to the original variables. So now these ones are order one over root lambda. And V was also order one over root lambda. So the important thing that I didn't emphasize was that when I found this classical minimum, this was actually in the regime where where it's all semi-classical. So it was self-consistent. That if I expand around the classical minimum, that is order one over root lambda. So this can be small, and this will be now order one over root lambda because this is one order one over root lambda. So this is something which doesn't have to be, it's independent of lambda. It's order one. But it doesn't have to be parametrically large as lambda gets small because this is doing that for you. I defined phi to be curly phi over root lambda, and then I wrote the Lagrangian this way. And then once I'd done this to show you the lambdas are all here, that was supposed to just convince you that if I now do the lambda series, it's going to be the loop series, and that the quantization problem should be I should start with the classical minimum, and I should be expanding around the classical minimum. But then when I actually define the classical minimum and do this perturbation theory, I'm actually going back to the original variables because they're actually more convenient. Because I was just making a point here, which having made, I'll never use these variables again.
sorry, when you were making this point about Lagrangian for free particle having some SM,
yeah.
How does that relate to our Lagrangian? Like, are these is our real and imaginary fields? This looks like...
Let me write the next nine, and it'll be clear. So I'm just going to just write this. I'm going to write this as just rewrite this. So the next line is I'm going to write L as being L naught plus L interaction, and L naught is going to be everything here that's quadratic. So it'll be minus 1/2 d mu psi right d mu psi right minus 1/2 d mu psi I d mu psi I. And then also there's a piece in the quadratic in the Lagrangian. So it's minus lambda over 2 b squared psi right squared. And the L interaction is everything that's left. So that'll be these two theorems. So it's minus lambda v over 2 root 2 psi right. And then there's also a minus lambda over 16. This gives me a Lagrangian, and I can calculate the Hamiltonians that are the analog of these things. And the idea is that in quantum mechanics, if you had a Hamiltonian that you could diagonalize, and then the real one that you wanted was a small difference between the one you could diagonalize and the real one you wanted, you could perturb in the difference. Yeah. So I'm going to do that now where L naught is the one I can diagonalize. It's the free particle. It's the one for which I can use this rule. Because everything's quadratic here. So these two guys tell me that this particle has mass lambda v squared.
Yes.
And this guy has mass zero. Because there's no psi I squared.
Okay.
And then this is the interaction. And so at the Feynman rule level, this will correspond to a vertex. If a solid line is a psi r particle and a dotted line is a psi I particle, this is something with three psi r's in it. So that's a vertex like that.
Yep.
This is two psi i's and one psi r. So that'll be a vertex like that. This has got four psi r, so that's like that.
Yep.
Four psi i's is like that. And then the cross term will be two of each. And so those are the Feynman, those are the interaction vertices we're going to have in perturbation theory. And then the Feynman graph story would just be to take, if I take this Lagrangian and I do perturbation theory in the time-dependent way, then the graphical expansion of the scattering will be the perturbative expansion of the scattering matrix in terms of powers of lambda will be just a bunch of graphs made of these things with the given external states that I have that I'm scattering. And then there'll be some specific rules for the numerical factors that go with those graphs.
So,
but you can see that the coefficient of each of these things will be the coefficient here. So that these two guys, the two cubic guys, are proportional to lambda v over 2 root 2. And these quartic guys are all proportional to lambda over 16. So I can count the lambdas for each vertex that way.
Yeah. My other question was, is the fact that we've popped out a zero mass for one of our particles a result of one of the approximations of
either zero? No, see, this is one of the punchlines will be that that's actually going to turn out to be an exact statement. So it sounds right now, all I would be able to say is that in perturbation theory in lambda, it starts off massless. And it might be that the corrections give it a mass. And so far, from everything I told you so far, you wouldn't know if there's a order. That might mean that the mass is order lambda to some power. But it's going to turn out that it's exactly zero. And that's because The reason, I can tell you why, the reason is that there's a symmetry in the problem that we broke. This, remember the phi, the original phi had a, you could multiply it by a phase and the Lagrangian was invariant. And that corresponded in the Mexican hat to running around in the circular direction along the bottom of the hat.
Oh, okay.
And so and these masses are turning out to be the second derivative of the potential. And if there's two directions, you want the eigenvalues of that matrix. And so the positive one is this guy, and the zero one is this guy, the symmetry one. So whenever you have a symmetry in the bottom of your potential, you're always going to have a massless guy because it costs no energy to go in that direction. And so that's called a Goldstone boson. And that's a very general thing, that when you have a symmetry of your potential and your minimum is not symmetric, so there's a whole one parameter family of minima related by the symmetry, they have to have the same energy because it's a symmetry, so it doesn't change the potential. And then you'll always get a massless state in that case. And this is a specific example of that. So topic number five is going to be Goldstone particles, and this is kind of an example of that, but there's a more general statement of that. Okay. How are we doing for time? We're out of time. So then let me stop here, because let me write down what the masses are, and then we'll stop. So if I compare, this formula to the quadratic part here, you see that psi right has a mass mr squared, which is lambda v squared. And then psi I has a mass, which is zero. And so when we count lambdas, it's going to be, there's a subtlety because there's a lambda hidden in the mass. So when we start looking at, you're going to see when we write the scattering, we're going to look at scattering of say phi I particles and phi r particles. And the scattering matrix will be proportional to the lambda. When I do the tree graphs, it's going to look like the tree graphs are giving me different powers of lambda, but that's because there will be a lambda hidden in the m. There's going to be an m in the denominator. So we're going to get a lambda plus a lambda squared over m squared. And so if I think of v being fixed as lambda small, you'll see that this is they count the same number of lambdas in them. So this is a good place to stop. Next thing we'll do is we'll actually take these Feynman rules. I'll just tell you what they are. We don't have to figure them out. And then we'll calculate the scattering of two I particles with an R particle. And we'll calculate the scattering of two I particles with the I particles. And we'll use these vertices. And I'll put in the factors. And you'll see that it's not a big deal getting the factors right. And there's going to be an amazing cancellation that happens, which will look like it's a miracle. It looks like these guys should be interacting at zero momentum, because this is all happening at zero momentum. But you'll see that these scattering amplitudes are going to actually vanish at zero momentum. And that's, again, a very general consequence of these things being Goldstone bosons, SII. And so there's a simpler way to do this calculation than the way I'm doing it now. And that's kind of part of the motivational story. So I'll see you guys at 2:30.